Well, when the European Union was created, this was in 1957, life on the continent was pretty dire. Back then, much of Berlin was still in ruins. In Britain, food rationing had just ended. If you go across to the eastern half of Europe, back then it was dominated by nasty communist dictatorships. Yet over time, it's fair to say, living standards dramatically improved. So did health. Indeed, life expectancy has increased. And yet these days, a sense of doom and gloom hangs over the whole continent, doesn't it? So much so that my next guest says we're witnessing the end of Europe. James Kirchick is a visiting fellow at the Centre of the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution in Washington, and he's the author of The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age. He's in Australia this week as a guest of the Australia-Israel-Jewish Affairs Council. James, welcome to ABC Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Now, why are you so pessimistic about Europe?
Well, I think we had three broad assumptions about Europe in 1989 when the Berlin Wall collapsed. The first was that this would be an era of perpetual peace, the famous Frank Fukuyama end of history thesis. The second was that Europe would be a place of perpetual democracy, that the continent was being reunited under democratic governments. And the third was that regulated market capitalism had triumphed over socialism. And I think all three of these assumptions are being really torn asunder. We have a security threat in the form of Russia, which has come back as an aggressive power on the continent. And then there's the whole migrant crisis and the rise of Islamic terrorism across the continent. In terms of democracy, we see democratic backsliding in places like Hungary, where the prime minister has openly called for illiberal democracy, and some pretty negative moves in Poland. And then in terms of capitalism is really under a serious scrutiny. We have the left in Europe is now becoming increasingly socialist and rejecting the basic tenets of capitalism itself. And so I think all three of the assumptions that we associated with Europe are being seriously challenged.
Let's deal with immigration. You write in your book, across the continent, quote, once marginal, anti-systemic parties increase their popularity at the expense of mainstream ones almost entirely because of their absolutist stance against immigration. Explain.
I think for a long time there had been this sort of elite consensus across the center-left and the center-right on basically liberal immigration policies. And in many cases, these were out of touch with popular opinion. I think we can attribute Brexit to a serious disagreement between elite leaders in immigration. I think it was largely a reaction to the migrant crisis. In Sweden, there's a country now, the Sweden Democrats, which barely even existed a decade ago, is now one of the largest parties in the country, a virulently anti-immigrant party. And in Germany, I think most worryingly of all, there's a far-right party in the Bundestag, the Alternative for Deutschland, for the first time since the early 1950s. And that's solely attributable to the anger over Chancellor Merkel's pro-immigration policy.
Right. Okay, now you mentioned Angela Merkel. No question her decision to throw open Europe's doors to refugees at the height of the Syrian civil war in 2015, hugely controversial.
It wasn't just the refugees from the Syrian civil war, and that's the problem.
Right.
If it was just the refugees from the Syrian civil war, that would be one thing, but there was many, many people who were economic migrants, many people from countries that were not at war, people from Pakistan were coming. So that's part of the reason why there was so much.
Was she wrong to do this because they were Muslim?
Not because they're Muslim, but I think the fact that they are Muslim makes it a more complicated question. Clearly Europe, many European countries have not done a very good job of integrating the Muslim communities that have been there for decades already. Yeah. And this is a very serious challenge. And I think it should have been taken with more intelligence and more thoughtfulness.
Some of her defenders at the time said that these refugees were a perfect solution to Germany's labor shortage.
Well, the European Union is an economic union. And if you look at countries in the south where youth unemployment is at 50%, places like Greece or Italy or Spain, certainly those countries, I think, would be better sources of labor for Germany than people from the Middle East who don't speak the language and don't share the same culture.
Yeah, well, how does the EU, though, deal with this challenge more effectively, given the continent's close proximity to the Middle East as well as Africa?
This is really the most difficult question, because if you look at the population growth in Africa, if you look at the political instability in the Middle East, all these factors are going to, over the future, I think, drive immigration waves towards the European continent. I think the EU needs to invest in these places. There's a Marshall Plan for Africa, economic development, opening up their trade There's very, very protectionist trade policies that the EU has, particularly, you know, French agriculture and whatnot. And they're going to have a more coherent foreign policy so that they can try to bring about stability in the regions around their periphery so that they're not continually faced with the sorts of migrant influxes that they saw in 2015.
Okay, that's immigration. Let's deal with the question of democratic backsliding. Now, I put your argument essentially to one prominent European defender of the populist wave, and his response was, James, that the rise of populism, far from representing a threat to democracy, it reflects healthy public discourse. This is what Georges Schoffelin, he's a Hungarian member of the European Parliament, this is what he told me in 2017.
Of the population is estranged from the hegemonic liberal elite. It's not the kind of liberalism they want. In street language, they're being dissed. The net result of which is that they listen to political groups which say, look, we will look after your interests. This is what Marine Le Pen has done in France. Look at the figures for the alternative in Germany, Alternative für Deutschland. They do very well in the former GDR. The former GDR was treated by West Germany as, I'm going to exaggerate a bit, as a semi-colony. Their own voice was not heard very large. It's the losers of globalization who are being excluded from the political system by the winners. So don't be surprised that there is what you would call a backlash.
That was Georges Schoffelin, a Hungarian MP in the European Parliament. He's a strong supporter of Viktor Orban, who's one of your bogeymen in your book, James. Hasn't what he calls the left-wing elite in Europe failed, which explains this populist backlash?
Well, I mean, I'll certainly grant him on the issue of immigration, which we've discussed, that there is a gap between elites and most people.
And by the way, that tough line on immigration has reaffirm public support for Orban,
yes,
correct?
It has. But look, the democratic backsliding that has occurred in Hungary began in 2010, right after Mr. Orban was elected. That's 5 years before the migrant crisis. Furthermore, it's ironic always to hear Hungarian public leaders, you know, assail the EU, from whom they receive billions of dollars every year in terms of structural adjustment policies. Most of the public works and infrastructure projects that have taken place in Hungary and other Central and Eastern European countries since the collapse of communism come from Germany and come from France and Britain and the wealthier countries of the West. So it's a little bit of biting the hand that feeds them. And I also, frankly, you cannot use these sorts of arguments that Mr. Schoffelin is using to defend assaults on the judiciary, judicial independence, the basic checks and balances of a society. These are the basic indicators of liberal government, small l, that the people who believe in democracy have to support. And so just sort of flailing your arms and saying, well, the liberal elites, they're out of touch with the people, that doesn't justify the attacks on the judiciary and basically turning the country into a one-party state.
My guest is James Kirchick. He's the author of The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age. Let's move on to Russia, James. On this program over the years, we've had some distinguished Russia watchers, such as Professor Stephen Cohen from NYU, Mary Dejevsky from The Independent in Britain, John Mearsheimer from the University of Chicago, and they take issue with you when you say that Russia's a serious threat to Europe, and they'd come back and say that Russia's a declining great power, the demographic trends are moving in the wrong direction, and it's addicted to petrodollars. John Mearsheimer says that Russia's just a giant gas station. So is Russia really a threat to Europe?
First of all, I take issue with your characterization of Professor Cohen as distinguished. He's probably the most infamous defender of Vladimir Putin in the Western world. All those things about Russia can be true. It certainly is declining in terms of population and has not modernized its economy. It is addicted to petrodollars. That doesn't mean it can't be a threat. It just perpetrated in 2014 the first armed territorial annexation on the European continent since World War II, and it's waging a war in eastern Ukraine. And look, all you have to do is talk to the peoples of Central and Eastern Europe. Talk to the Estonians, talk to the Poles. Talk to the Czechs and the Slovaks, and they'll tell you a very different story. And I think those people's narratives and those people's experiences are being completely ignored in order to appease Russia. And those countries are members of the European Union, and they're members of NATO, and we have obligations to them.
Defenders of Putin would say that NATO expansion upset the strategic sensibilities of Russia, and that as a great power, even though it's a declining one, it plays hardball to protect its vital interests in its near abroad. And so the attempts to expand NATO onto Russia's borders and help bring down Yanukovych in February of 2014, that provoked Russia into responding to take the Crimea because that was the home of the Russian Black Sea Fleet.
They would say that, and they would be wrong. I think that it's Russian behavior over the past 10 years, which shows why NATO expansion, or enlargement as I would put it, has been a good idea. I think if we hadn't enlarged NATO to places like Poland and the Baltic states, you and I would be having a totally different conversation about the security of those countries. But thankfully, they are in NATO, and we're not so worried about their security.
Donald Trump, you once described him as the most pro-Russian presidential candidate in generations. You said he got his own Republican Party to love Putin. And watching that Helsinki press conference about a year ago, I can see what you mean. However, how do you account for the fact that under Trump's leadership, Washington has indeed expanded NATO, strengthened sanctions on Moscow, supplied the Ukrainian military with lethal weapons, boosted aid to the Baltic countries, and launched missiles against Russia's ally, Assad, twice, 2017 and 2018. Doesn't sound like a Russian stooge to me.
No, and I think that the policies of the Trump administration are actually quite salutary towards Russia. It comes as quite a surprise, given the rhetoric that he was voicing during the campaign. I think it's largely in spite of the president, and not necessarily because of him. There are strong Russia hawks in the administration, in the Defense Department, the State Department, the National Security Council. One friend has put it to me that oftentimes you have to see Donald Trump as a visiting fellow at the White House. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of explanations for this. I think he somewhat feels boxed in by the whole Mueller investigation and the controversy. Yeah,
which actually has vindicated him, at least on the question of collusion.
It did. But I think during that whole rigmarole in Washington, he didn't want to be perceived as being in the pocket.
And yet you have argued, now this admittedly was at the height of Russiagate, just after he became the president, you argue that Trump threatens peace and prosperity. See, the realists in response would say that, you know, it's been 30 years since the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Berlin Wall. Why continue a Cold War alliance 30 years after the end of the Cold War?
Well, because the Russians are once again waging war in Europe. They've annexed territory in Crimea. They are increasing their defense budget, their military exercises. They have they were cheating on the intermediate range nuclear forces treaty during the Obama years. So it's the Russians who have upset the strategic balance in Europe, and I think that means NATO is all the more important.
Okay, finally, 2020, the conventional wisdom, and I think this is a fair assessment, the Democrats have lurched well to the left, doesn't get enough coverage in Australia because we're so focused on Trump, but if you look at the leading Democrat candidates, they've moved well to the ideological left during these primaries. James, will that make it easier for Donald Trump's re-election next year?
Absolutely. I think he's already doing this, but he's going to run against, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, the squad, basically, and socialism. And he's already doing it. He's doing it every day. And I think the Democrats continually play into his hands. They are so opposed to him that they not only have to oppose his policies, they basically have to take the exact opposite. So Donald Trump supports a wall on our southern border. We're going to support open borders. And you know what? If it's a battle between those two positions, Donald Trump is going to win. And that goes for so many issues across the board.
James, great to have you on Between the Lines today.
Thank you.
James Kirchick from the Brookings Institution in Washington is author of The End of Europe, and we'll put a link to the book on our website.